Get around the radio, kids. It's time for Strictly Confidential. It's the homosexual agenda on steroids, putting the dominionists and the loyal Bushies and the rest of America's underbelly on notice that the GLBT community is simply not going to take it anymore. So, just like gay kryptonite, here's Peter Godbold.
Good evening, America, and good morning, world. Welcome to Book, Chapter, and Verse 102 of Strictly Confidential. I am Peter Godbold, and welcome, welcome indeed to the LGBT version of Conversation Radio, exclusively on listener-supported Head On Radio Network. Thank you so much for making Strictly Confidential a part of your day. Today is, in fact, Wednesday, January the 16th, 2008. So if you're listening shortly after 9 p.m., on a Wednesday evening, that is January the 16th, you are indeed listening to a live show, and you're welcome to phone in and talk to myself. It's a Just Us evening on Strictly Confidential, so when you call, you'll just be talking to myself. And that is 877, the number 4 head-on. That translates into 877-443-2366. Both of those numbers, that's the translation. Those are both toll-free. If you have unlimited long distance, please use that and save the studio a nickel or a buck. That's area code 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com, and I do try to check the mail during the breaks. Show site is strictlyconfidentialradio.com, and there you'll find links to all of the guests and to the audio archives from past shows, as well as to the chat room and the Head On Radio Network main site. There you can find out about all of the other progressive programming on the Head On Radio Network. There are links there also for Strictly Confidential's MySpace page, and links for they'll help you locate the music if you'll stop by the MySpace page. Speaking of MySpace, I'm just making a few adjustments here for sound, and that ought to make the studio happy. There we go. Speaking of MySpace, I had an interesting thing happen today. All of a sudden, out of a clear blue sky, I heard from a fellow on MySpace, and we chatted back and forth for a couple of minutes about, via email regarding the show and himself and his history. And turns out that this fellow, it just completely blew me away. I was floored this afternoon. This fellow, one moment, another studio adjustment. There we go. Okay, now this fellow, his name is Ronnie Kerr. Now, Ronnie Kerr, interestingly enough, plays Billy in my very favorite movie on the whole planet called Regarding Billy, which just absolutely blew me away. There are three movies that are listed on MySpace as being my favorite movies. One of them is called Red Dirt. The other is called Gone But Not Forgotten, and the other is called Regarding Billy, and I just fell out. It just amazed me. I've got to tell you, explain to you that it's such an honor to be the host of this show. I'm being able to meet and talk with people that there's no way I would ever have met or talked to. Those of you who have listened to this show regularly know that our guests over the last 6 months have been some of the most intelligent and astute and articulate people on the planet regarding their areas of expertise. I've certainly enjoyed meeting each and every one, and then all of a sudden, the fellow that plays Billy and Regarding Billy and I hooked up this afternoon. What an interesting thing. Anyway, we'll be scheduling Ronnie Kerr. By the way, he has a list of movie credits as long as my arm. I had no idea that that was the case, but there you go about Ronnie Kerr. Our DJ tonight, by the way, in the Gay Bar Across the Street segment will be Larry Sanders, the world's most dangerous DJ. We're always looking forward to Larry Sanders' tracks. Tomorrow night, VJC will be manning the turntables again. Friday, it will be Bobby Vittoretti. Monday will be, fasten your seatbelts, will be Alex Natikken, and he is using a DJ in the Netherlands. He's a Dutch DJ. His name is DJ Martin Verlan, and I have got to tell you, that is just the most incredible. You'll love it. And it's because it's a tallow disco. You'll understand when you hear the music. And of course, joining us on Tuesday for the Gay Bar Across the Street segment, this is in the last half hour of the program, by the way, will be our very own Billy Shears. And Billy is also a master of his craft. By the way, if you'd like to hear the Larry Sanders interview, our DJ for this evening, he interviewed this month, and I believe that was on December the 3rd. January the 3rd. Just a few days back, and you can locate that interview by going to strictlyconfidentialradio.com and going to the calendar date of the 3rd. A little follow-up regarding what Bob was saying regarding funding for some of our new listeners. I get emails from new people all of the time, and just so you'll know, the Head On Radio Network is fully supported by the listeners, and also, so you know, when you do go to the headonradionetwork.com site, you'll find the PayPal button there. But I want you to know that none of those funds goes into our pockets. It doesn't go into Bob's pocket, nor does it go into John's or any of the other hosts on the network, including myself. All of us are, as they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, fully self-supporting by our own contributions. And that being the case, I wanted you to know that the funding there goes for keeping the streams streaming and the packets passing and the reels turning on the tape decks and the CDs spinning. Although we do this network as a labor of love, we are not able to find computer vendors and Internet service providers that will allow us to use their facilities as a labor of love. Now, that's not actually true with CityNet. We have a relationship with CityNet that they help us and we help them, but nonetheless, we do get a nice hefty T1 bill at the end of every month there for the studio in West Virginia. By the way, it is a dark and stormy night here in North Florida. It's been raining all day since the crack of dawn. It's been raining. Hasn't stopped. It's supposed to be heavier this evening. We're hoping that all the Internet's packets make it to where they're going this evening. So far, so good. Everything seems to be stable on this end, and that's always a good thing. So, where do we begin? Ah, yes. First, I want to let all of our bisexual listeners know that it's not just a phase. I know you've been waiting for years to find this out, but it is the duh headline of the day. Women's bisexuality is an identity and not a phase. This is of great interest. The new study from the University of Utah shows that bisexuality in women isn't just a phase. Now, there's a person there, her name is Lisa Diamond, and she's an associate professor of psychology. She has conducted face-to-face interviews around New York State in that area since 1995. Now, the original group of people who identified themselves as lesbians, bisexuals, or unlabeled, but none identified as heterosexuals, were all between the ages of 18 and 25. Now, she has been following them with telephone interviews every 2 years since that time. And it's interesting to find out that these people who called themselves bisexual at the time were still, in fact, bisexual. And this is of great interest. Seems to be a lot of people who want to say that, especially in the case of bisexual men, that they're just gay guys that don't really want to come out of the closet. It's becoming increasingly clear that that just isn't so. The study followed 79 non-heterosexual women and found that bisexual women continue to be attracted to both sexes over long periods of time, and that it is a distinct orientation, not a temporary stage. And these interviews have proven that conclusively. Their findings are more consistent with the model of bisexuality as a stable identity rather than a transitional stage. So all of you who have been bisexual for, 50, 60 years, you can breathe a sigh of relief. It's not just a phase. Diamond goes on to suggest that women possess the capacity to experience sexual desires for both sexes under the right situations. Diamond also says if it was a phase, it would have burned out by now. They have a change in identity and relationships, but the pattern of non-exclusive desire is still there. Also, there's no indication either that when a bisexual person settles down with one of the other, whether the same or opposite gender, that there is no indication that there's any frustration on their part by not having a mate of the other gender. So that's, it's not just a sexual thing, it is an emotional thing, which is what we've been trying to tell you for a long, long time. But that's just a by the way. I wanted to let you guys know that, in fact, you can breathe a sigh of relief. You really, really are bisexual. Interestingly enough, this is the story I wanted to tell you about the most. It's the most amazing bit of information I've come across. Hopefully we can get one of these folks from some of these organizations on the show at some time in the future. But the lead article is called Becoming a Black Man. And the subtitle, More Than a Trans Man, I Am a Black Man. Very, very interesting view of transsexuals and transgendered when they are not white Americans. Fellow named Lewis Mitchell. And now Lewis expected an awful lot of things when he began taking the hormone injection about 8 years ago. He was transitioning from female to male, from the female body to a male one. And he anticipated he was going to grow a beard, and he did, and he likes his beard. He knew his voice would deepen and that his relationships with his partner and his family and his friends would change, and in good ways, he hoped, and they did. All of that happened. But what he was not counting on was the changing way he drove, but let's put that in quotes. Within months, within just months, you see, he was female, but within months of starting to take the male hormones, he was pulled over. He calculated it at a 300% rate higher than he had been pulled over. This is by law enforcement, highway patrol, et cetera, et cetera. He had been pulled over 300% higher than he had been in previous 23 years of driving. He said it was astounding, and it was almost immediate. He was just shocked. Now, right now, he is living in Massachusetts. His story about this particular topic comes from the San Francisco area. So you see, he was being targeted for driving while black. Now, that wasn't new to Mitchell. Now, Mitchell was 46 years old, and I assume he's still about 46. But the few years before transitioning, example, he had been questioned by a cop for simply sitting in his own car late at night. The cops didn't really bother him that much, and especially the cops immediately backed off when they figured out that he was female. But now that Lewis is in a male body, he's just amazed. He's constantly pulled over for the slightest infractions. In fact, when he and his wife moved from California over to Massachusetts, Mitchell just refused flat out to let her drive with the cross-country trip because he was afraid. She drives too fast, he said. And there's no way he wanted to get pulled over and end up in some local hellhole and be transgendered and God knows. So he drove, and he said, and I quote here, he had to drive like a black man, meaning that he cannot go 90 miles an hour down the highway. He said, if I'm going 56 miles down the highway, miles per hour down the highway, I need to be concerned. And this is becoming increasingly apparent. As more people of color are transitioning, this story of the racial bias of the male, female, and being black in America is becoming increasingly common. The transgender community, as we all know, we've had, at least three guests who are transgendered on this show, some of them more than once. There's just a huge boom in invisibility for those folks over the last decade or so. And, you know, some of this has come about through just culture. We know about the movies, Boys Don't Cry. And then there was a Los Angeles Times sports writer who came out as transgendered. And then there have been books like the Testosterone Files and scientific books like the Transgender Study Reader. In any case, the transgender community is experiencing much greater visibility. And the key has been the work of transgender people themselves. As the hormones and the surgeries and the more widespread availability, more and more of them are choosing, rather than passing as heterosexual, an increasing number of them in the last decade anyway have identified as trans and have begun support and advocacy and working with legal rights groups. Of course, the Internet, or the Internets, as George Bush would put it, their social online networks, every form of communication is now available to them. This is the T of the LGBT rainbow. Things are changing in other countries, too. Transgendered folks in Latin America, Africa, Asia. Trans women in a lot of cultures have been marginally accepted. Read that, barely accepted. And they've been confined to traditionally feminine roles, you know, like caretakers, doing laundry, that sort of thing. But that's changing now, too, in places like Mexico and a list of other places. A trans woman ran for a political office in 2003. I think that was in Mexico. And some countries' activists are going to court, and they're winning huge policy decisions. In Brazil, a court ruled that a transsexual surgery reassignment is covered by the Constitution as a medical right. This is, you know, not in the U.S., mind you, not in the home of the brave and the historically free, but in countries like Brazil. It's very difficult to say how many people identify as being transgendered. The National Center for Transgender Equality has estimated that about 3 million people are transgendered in the U.S., and it's hard to say how many of those people are people of color. But there is an online group for black trans people called, and I'm pronouncing this as it is spelled, Trans Sisters and Trans Brothers. Love to get some people on that site. They have about 300 members, and there's a group specifically for the Latinos, for Latino trans men. They have a little over 100 members. And there's also been a huge increase in the number of people who are seeking what's called top surgeries, or removal of breasts, according to one of the researchers. He's a doctor who specializes in gender surgeries in San Francisco. And he says he does 4 to 6 top surgeries a week. And he notes that while 30 years ago, trans people would come to the office alone and nervous, but now trans people are arriving in his office with partners, with children, with friends for moral support, with mothers and fathers. Oh, my God, how the time is changing. And oh, how the Christian right wants us all to go back in the closet. But golly gee, nobody's headed there. Social changes, of course, have ushered in increasing acceptability for men and women to alter their physical bodies to match their gender. But what's not talked about and is pretty much unexamined is the issue of racism and how trans men and trans women experience it. Trans people of color are finding out that they have an extremely different relationship to gender transitioning than white people who are transitioning. Now, one fellow, his name is Dexter Ward, he's a Los Angeles Police Department, he was a policeman. He transgendered in 2004, and he sums it up this way: a white person who transgenders into a male body just becomes a man. By contrast, I became a black man, I became the enemy. So, in short, people of color who are transitioning are giving us some very clear indicators. People that we listen closer to them because they've been on both sides of it. It's hard to say, but it's becoming increasingly apparent that racism works differently for men and women. And transgender people like Mitchell that we talked about, who drove to Massachusetts and wouldn't let his wife drive, and Ward, who is the LAPD officer, they're getting to live both sides of the gender equation. Now, Lewis, we're back to the fellow who drove from California. He moved with his wife to California, and he transitioned from female to male. Lewis is the type of man who he quickly puts people at ease. He advises them about inexpensive housing in Massachusetts. He rents condos and I think a leasing agent. I don't exactly know. We hopefully have him on the show and he can explain all that to us. He calls himself a big black man. He is 5'9" tall, and he weighs 250 pounds. Now, in 2006, he did a whole lot of soul-searching, and he began attending divinity school. It's always remarkable to me how many LGBT folks, and indeed transgendered folks, are attracted to divinity school and learning more about spirituality and what the Bible does and doesn't say and does not say. Indeed, I have put forth the thought on this show that many times LGBT folks have to do a lot of soul-searching that straight folks do not have to do because we walk in and we're told that we're condemned 9 times out of 10, and so we have to do a lot of soul-searching to figure out that, in fact, we are not. So he is a warm-hearted man, and the reference here says that he could sell a 2-bedroom condo as easily as he could convince the congregation to be honest with God. He grew up in West Covina, which is in, I think I'm pronouncing that correctly, that's in Southern California. He attended church with his mother. He absolutely loved history. He devoured the history books. And when he was, or at the time she was, and at the age of 3 and 4, he knew that he was a boy. He knew that at that young age. And regardless, he knew it regardless of having been born in a girl's body. He also believed that God created miracles, and he prayed that when he grew up and that when he reached puberty, that he would turn into a man. That's what his most intimate prayer was, and of course that did not happen. So near the end of the 70s, Mitchell was about 18. This is Lewis. We're talking about Lewis Mitchell. He was about 18, and he hitchhiked with a friend to Corpus Christi, Texas. One of the reasons they did that, the legal age was, you know, these, you know, young people partying, what have you. The legal age for drinking was lower than in California in those days. And he, as the right would say, he fell in with a coven of drag queens. That's not exactly the way this is presented. He met a number of drag queens there, and he felt hopeful for the very first time in his life that if the queens could be women, he was thinking, then there might be options for him to live as a man. So at the time, there was a black transsexual woman. She was had already been the very first person to undergo a sex reassignment surgery over at Johns Hopkins University. And according to a classic book called How Sex Changed, A History of Transsexuality in the United States, that's a mouthful. According to that book, that transition that took place in 1966 at Johns Hopkins marked a turning point for the transsexual community. It was the first time a medical clinic in the United States had performed the surgery, and so while it was very rare, it was approved. It was an approved surgery. So at least in his mind, in Lewis's mind, it was a possibility. So he went on to identify as just being butch, and he was masquerading as being a lesbian, and that was the way he identified himself. And it was about 15 years ago from today, about 15 years back, a friend of his began the process of transitioning to a male body. And according to Lewis, that lit a fire under him that he could not put out. He had met a few black trans men at a conference, but it took many, many, many years for him to work this out personally for his own transition. He thought about it very carefully. The consequences, it would impact his mother, who he was very attached to. He would also lose all of his friends in the lesbian community by transitioning. But he never considered racism. That was not part of the picture. There were all these other it's just amazing that it's racism that's affecting him more than anything else. He already had a goatee, and he was taking hormones, and he was used to being followed every time he went in the store, a grocery store, a clothing store, whatever. And he was accustomed to women who would clutch their purses at the very sight of him. And so he was really surprised about the changes that came after taking the injections of the hormone, the degree to which he became a target. And he was beginning to feel for the first time in his life the emotional changes and the emotional experiences of the black male experience in this country. Mitchell points out that before he transitioned, he was a bit cavalier and reckless about, you know, what he did in public, you know, partying, maybe his interaction with the police. He just didn't think about it very much. So you see, because at some point, if there was a confrontation with the police and any discussion, you know, at some point they'd figure out that he was female, and at that point the situation would always diffuse. This is something that happened over and over and over again in Mitchell's experience. So he doesn't do that anymore. He doesn't do small transgressions anymore, like jaywalking or spitting on the sidewalk. He said, I never knew that they're just waiting for something to happen and just waiting to roll up on you. And I didn't want to find myself in custody because that would be very, very dangerous in so many, many ways. He lived, as I said, in San Francisco before he moved to Massachusetts, and he lived in the historic neighborhood called Castro, which is lots of clubs and gay folks live in the Castro areas, where I think most everyone knows. But he got tired of being followed in stores. So during the cross-country trip with his wife, he would refrain from any affectionate kissing with her in public. He didn't want to run the risk of drawing any attention to himself. You see, he's a black man, but she is mixed race, Latina. So, and oft times, she's perceived as being white. So here he was concerned about him being a transitioning black man and being with a white woman, and in some parts of the state or the country, that's still a pretty scary thing. He says, more than a transsexual, I am a black man, Mitchell says. And he said he'd be in an intensive care before they realized that he was a trans man in terms of exposure with his wife. Another fellow named Gomez transitioned back in 2001 and describes the situation with racism and violence as being a trade-off. He says, I may not be able to walk down the street and not be raped unless they know my status as a trans man. But there's a different kind of threat from men. Before transitioning, Gomez was used to being pulled over in his car and stopped in San Francisco. And the cops would call him an A-S-S-H-O-L-E and other derogatory names until they saw the F on the driver's license. And as soon as they saw the female indicator on the driver's license, he was presenting masculine in a masculine way. The police officers would immediately back down. There were times when he would be walking through the neighborhood regarding other people that someone would refer to him as a bitch and simply drop it. But Gomez is concerned because these things now don't go with a one-word slur. They lead often to much more violence. And getting back to Ward, Ward has seen his life change too because of the racism. Says, this was an astounding remark to me. I do a lot of shopping online now because I'm tired of being followed in bookstores and clothing stores. This just blew me away. Of all the reasons people shop online, the cost of gas, the convenience, the fact that you don't have time anymore because you're working two jobs and you have three kids, are doing a talk radio show. It's conversation radio, by the way, not talk. You'd like, call it. It's 877, the number 4, head on, or 304-658-3333, and we can talk about whatever's on your mind. But in any case, he does his shopping online, a whole new market for the online retailers, is it not? Who would have thought? Now, Ward was the police officer we talked about earlier. He's 44, and with the LAPD, we mentioned that just a little while ago. And he started his hormone treatments in 2004, and he transitioned while he was still working for LAPD. At this point, he is an instructor at the police academy, and transitioning on the job was really not a small thing at all. It meant that he had to move to the men's locker room, and he had to move to the men's showers, but amazingly enough, Ward's coworkers and his supervisors, just like his family, completely accepted him. And in fact, just touched me. It was with the locker room humor sort of thing. You know how the boys are in the locker room with their humor. The sergeant created a penalty jar, and any time a cop said anything that was something that might be a slur or something that directed. They had to deposit a quarter if they referred to Ward by a female pronoun. So it was a slur or just being female. And, that's how it should be. Things should be that simple. Instead of this militant hate that we see coming from every quarter, I just don't get it. What is it with people and sex? I just don't understand. It seems that our lizard brains are very directly connected to our hate, are they not? And something about sex, it's hard to say. He says, I was prepared for being a trans man. I was not prepared for being a black man. You know, this is a really wonderful and different view of the way these things work. I'd love to have one of these folks in the show. I'm going to pursue that here in the future. He finds that people will look at him very differently. Now we're talking about the LAPD officer. They look at him differently, and they look at him with great fear when he walks into a bar or a restaurant. He used to go to these same bars and restaurants, by the way, and have a great time. But people start being afraid of you, and you stop wanting to hang out in those places. And experiencing racism as a black man doesn't necessarily... It's a very interesting psychological thing here. Just because he's experiencing racism as a black man, it doesn't really give him... doesn't necessarily provide him any bond with his black male peers, because they grew up in a black male body, you see. So they have experienced racism being a black male for many, many, many years. They've experienced it as black boys. They've experienced it as black men. They've experienced driving while being a black male. It's just a matter of living for them. Not that it's right, not that it's the way you should feel, but for them it has become something that they handle, and that it's just a matter of living. So it's no longer strange for them to notice, that people are looking at them and that sort of thing. I mean, I know they don't appreciate it, but it's just that it's a spiritual thing you have to wear if you're a black man. But Mitchell says it's like gravity. He said it's like the law of gravity. I'm a black man, therefore, if something is stolen while I'm in the neighborhood, I am the suspect. He was completely unprepared for that. Racism for black trans men is really only part of the story. Mitchell says his manhood is not about the racism he encounters. It's more about the integrity and the sense of being the truest person I can be. And he adds that his gender transition is about his insides matching his outsides, finally. And he sees himself as joining a group of men who are perpetual targets, being a black man. Now, he feels he's joined a community of men that are strong but not ashamed of tenderness. And Mitchell finds that he's in a unique position now to mentor young black men. And this is very interesting, the way he handles that. As someone who came of age as a lesbian in the lesbian community, he is completely aware of feminist politics. And so Mitchell jokes back and forth with black boys who talk about fags and refer to women as bitches. And when that happens, he pulls the teenagers aside and uses reverse psychology and tells them that it's not okay to do that if people are gay. So the teens always protest. They protest that yes, it is okay to say those things. And so the reverse psychology he uses, and surely this was a gift to him from having lived both sides of the fence. He says to the kid, "Well, you have no respect for women, and you're fixated on gay men. So what am I supposed to think?" I love it. Love the logic there, which, of course, horrifies them and causes people to rethink. Another fellow, this is a priceless story, he's a black man. He lives in San Francisco, and he jokes about now that he enjoys certain perks. And one of the perks that he enjoys, he says he's finally being taken seriously by the guys who work at Home Depot. Oh, dear Lord, you got to love that. He said before he would go to Home Depot, they'd look at him like, "Shut up, girl," and they didn't want to talk to him. So trans men of color are finding that some things stay the side of both sides of the gender equation, and some things are very, very different. Cultural expectations, for example, are very hard to shake. The fellow Gomez was raised with his brothers and a couple of children with his partner. And he's now taking care of his mom. See, his mom suffers from Alzheimer's disease. So Gomez doesn't see any contradiction in the fact that he is a man, but he bathes his 60-year-old mother. Interesting point here he makes. I am the only one my mother trusts. She sees me as her daughter, but she knows me as being a man. But she see it. It's amazing that the transition, the things people go through. There's a black trans woman named Monica, and she's 45. She transitioned in 1994. So now she went from male to female. So she's thrilled. She says she's happy to no longer be considered a suspect. I'm like, you know, it's not funny, but you have to laugh. I laugh at the condition of the LGBT community, because if you don't, it'll drive you crazy. Now, as a black woman, now she's no longer considered a suspect, she says. So since she has transitioned back in 1994, she has not been pulled over once for driving while black. This is amazing stuff to me. And she adds quickly that it did happen to another friend who was a black trans woman, but there was a traffic incident or something. But she says her black trans friends have experienced something different, though, after transitioning, and that's a power shift. And she explained something I wasn't aware of regarding the black community, at least from her perspective. She says that black culture is matriarchal and based from the feminine. She says that most of the leadership in the black community is made up of very powerful women. She says there's a lot of them in my hometown. And so as Roberts transitioned, her name is Roberts, she stepped into that role, that role of feminine or female leadership. She grew up in Houston, Texas. She grew up in a black church. Her mother's a teacher. She was surrounded by women who are historians and leaders in the community. And she understood the influence of black women. She says that you might have a minister up there preaching in the pulpit on Sunday, but the real power, she says, the real power that sits on the throne is the women's auxiliary unit that meets on Tuesday. You gotta love this stuff. Oh my! She's her father's a local radio commentator, and I tried to groom her for leadership because she was the eldest child. And so anyway, so obviously after she transgendered, she felt able to. She was coached and able to take on a leadership role. Perhaps, she says, it was due to the toll it takes for living in the tranny closet. I do think the tranny closet is a different closet than the others of us know. It must be a pretty scary place. So she said she also noticed a difference in responses she received from other people to her leadership as a black woman. She got positive reactions because she was at that point had become doing what she calls her traditional work of black women in the community in terms of uplifting race. So back in 05, she and other transsexuals and transgendered started the first black trans conference in, of all places, Louisville, Kentucky, where she now lives. Just amazing what goes on in the heartland, is it not? Just amazing. She writes for an LGBT blog. And by the way, if you're interested in stopping by there, the blog is called TransG. Well, I should spell it. It's an odd... TransGriot. It's the word riot with the beginning of transgender. TransGriot.blogspot.com. So anyway, in 2006, she became the third black person to receive a Trinity Award, which recognizes people and their contributions to the transgendered community. There's also a story here about a Korean woman who transgendered back in 1997, now 46 years old. And one of the things she noticed about her transition was she was living as an Asian man, and now she's living as an Asian woman. Other than the internal joy of actualizing and being what she always felt that she was, she finds that she's gone from being invisible to very visible. And she said, see, being an effeminate Asian male, it tends to, she says, put you either mostly invisible. No one pays that much attention to you. But if you're perceived to be an Asian woman, what happens is the exact opposite, which is sexual interest and even harassment. She has found on more than one occasion she's been followed out of a subway and had to run to her house to get away from the person pursuing her. She says on that occasion she wasn't sure if she was being pursued because she was a woman or if they figured out she was a transgendered woman. You got to love this. I always wear shoes I could run in. Nothing like sensible shoes, huh, listeners? Always wear shoes I could run in. And she concedes that she knew that Asian women were exoticized, as she puts it. But, boy, experiencing it is a whole different subject. And so that pretty much wraps that particular story up. I found it incredibly interesting because not only is it being on both sides of the sexual, the gender, male, female, but who knew the added complications of being a black person going through those things? Gee, I have rattled on for 40 minutes. You know, that's going to break my contract. I'm going to have to get my attorneys to talk to the whore. I've been running off for 40 minutes, buddy. So Bob, I guess what we'll do is go to break with the track that we set up earlier this evening. It's called A Song for the Lonely. So as we come up on break, you're listening to Strictly Confidential. Toll-free, 877, the number 4, head-on. I am your host, Peter Godbull, streaming exclusively on listener-supported Head-On Radio Network. We'll be right back.
let it find you. Wherever you may go, I'm right beside you. Don't have to look no more. You don't have to look no more. Oh no.
You want to save big on your phone bill, and we know how you can.
That's right. We do.
We're saving more than 50% on our home phone bill since we switched to CityNet's digital phone plan.
Really? Over 50%?
CityNet's digital phone plan is only $24.95 a month.
Only $24.95?
You get unlimited local and long-distance calling.
Just $24.95.
And with CityNet's digital phone plan, you keep your current number. All you need is a high-speed internet connection. Get details at citynet.net.
$24.95.
And, oh, this is cool. With CityNet's digital plan, I can use my home phone anywhere in the world with high-speed internet. No extra cost.
There's 20, and there's 4, and there's 95.
Did I mention CityNet is a West Virginia-owned company?
Did I mention $24.95?
Save at least 50% on your residential phone. Get unlimited local and long distance, and keep your same number, all for just $24.95 a month. Visit citynet.net today for more details. Some exclusions and restrictions may apply.
Here's the guy changing the way you hear music, Billy Shears.
Tune in to Night Sounds every Saturday night, 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern. You'll hear the latest in new music releases, special segments like One Hit Wonders, Under the Covers, and Night Sounds dedications with the sassy and classy Erica Richards. For requests and dedications, direct your email to nightsounds@billyshearsmusic.com. So tune in and stop by the chat room this Saturday night at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here on the Head On Radio Network, The Horn.
Hey. Thanks for lending an ear.
Listen, man, adding fractions is no big deal.
Nah?
Nah. You just got to find what they call the common denominator. Let me show you.
All right.
Now, see these bottom numbers?
Yeah.
These are the denominators. That one's a 4, and that one's an 8.
Mm-hmm.
You just double both of these numbers, so that becomes an 8, too. Then you add them up.
Man, you sure make this easy.
Charles Bennett always dreamed that after college he'd return to the old neighborhood as a teacher. But without the money for tuition, only half of his dream came true. He's back in the old neighborhood.
Well, enough math. I gotta deliver these sandwiches.
Oh, sure.
Please support the United Negro College Fund. Call 1-800-332-UNCF. A mind is a terrible thing to waste. A public service brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
And we're back for the second hour of Strictly Confidential. It's actually a crazy little thing called love that we formally refer to as Strictly Confidential. And I am Peter Gottbold, and I am the homosexual agenda on steroids. And don't you forget it. The toll-free line is 877, the number 4, head-on. That's 877-4, head-on. The long-distance line, if you have unlimited long-distance, please use that. It saves the studio a nickel or a buck. That's area code 304-658-3333, and that rings in West Virginia. Email arrives to Peter at headonradionetwork.com. I'm so sorry, but I didn't neglected to check the email during the break. I was chatting with Bob and enjoying the track, actually. Our DJ for the final hour, the last half hour, as I explained to you earlier, was our dear friend Larry Sanders out in California, the world's most dangerous DJ, and Larry actually sent in that share track today, sent that share track to me, and I've got to tell you that I had never, ever, ever heard it before, but that's the thing about Larry, you just always surprised. But it was such a wonderful track I had to run. Actually, I was enjoying the track and not thinking about the email, so if you have emailed me, I am sorry, but I will check it. I will check it a little bit later. And let's see where we're headed now. This one is it's too hard to pass up. It's like shooting chickens at the cage. Okay, hang on to your post toasties. The American Civil Liberties Union argues on the behalf of Senator Larry Craig that sex in a restroom stall is private, and that people who have sex in public bathrooms have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Told you he was going to get off. I didn't realize that the ACLU was going to get involved. But in any case, they are filing this. You know, the ACLU, this is what is so amazing to me, that the right wants to beat up the ACLU all the time, where the ACLU has so, in so many cases, argued for them regarding prayer and there's a whole list of I read an article once. I'll have to look it up and read you the list of the things that you would be shocked to hear that the ACLU argued for, because it's part of what America is about. We have rights here that are as quickly as possible being taken away, but we do have a few rights left. Now, you recall Larry Craig is Wide Stance Larry, the Republican who he pled guilty to disorderly conduct stemming from a bathroom sex sting in the Minneapolis airport. So the ACLU filed a brief yesterday, supporting Craig. It cited a Minnesota Supreme Court ruling 38 years ago, that would have been in 1980, that found that people who have sex in closed stalls in public restrooms, the key word is a closed stall, have a reasonable expectation of privacy. Rather, you know, talk about low rent rendezvous. Oh, it's amazing to me. It means, of course, that the state cannot prove that Craig was inviting an undercover officer to have sex with him in public. The key here is public. The ACLU wrote. Of course, he was arrested on June the 11th, and and people from all over the world would begin a pilgrimage to the Minneapolis airport, maybe not for that specific purpose of flying to Minneapolis to see that restroom, but nonetheless the lines began forming at the door from people all over the world who wanted to see the restroom that Larry Craig was doing the toe-tap and wide stance dance in, and swiping his hand under the stall divider in doing the hand puppet hoochie-coo that signaled that he wanted sex. And, of course, Craig has denied that, saying that his intentions were misconstrued. The ACLU argued that even if Craig was inviting the officer to have sex, his actions were not illegal because the stall door is closed, and the Supreme Court in Minneapolis ruled that people who have sex in closed stalls and public restrooms have a reasonable expectation of privacy. So the ACLU goes on to say that the government cannot prove beyond a reasonable doubt that Senator Craig was inviting the undercover officer to engage in anything other than regular old, plain old sexual intimacy that would not have called attention to itself in a closed stall in the public restroom. The ACLU also noted that Craig was originally charged with interfering with privacy, which it said was an admission by the state that people in bathroom stalls expect privacy. Lord have mercy. Of course, the right wing is going to say that, you know, the ACLU is defending public sex, but nonetheless, the ACLU is simply following the laws, whether they be changed or not. It's hard to say. I personally think that not having sex in public restrooms is not only cheap and tawdry, it's just not tasteful. But, oh my, it's amazing to me. Oh yeah, the audio that Bob played earlier, the about Huckabee saying that he's going to change the Constitution to follow the Bible. Bob has the audio somewhere. He says, and I quote, "I have opponents in this race who do not want to change the Constitution." This is he said this in Michigan on Monday. "But I believe it's a lot easier to change the Constitution than it would be to change the Word of the Living God, and that's what we need to do. We need to amend the Constitution." He's talking about the United States, by the way. "We need to amend the Constitution so that it's in God's standards rather than try to change God's standards to line up with contemporary views." Of course, to do that, it would be done selectively, of course. This is the way they do things. No way would they bring back a public stoning of women who committed adultery, or chopping off the hand of a woman who touched a man's genitals who was not her husband, or any number of the other Old Testament rules and regulations that are conveniently ignored, except for ones that they purport to apply to us, because we are the dangerous menace. Yes, do you know that? Yeah, I'm almost on target. I'm right on schedule, actually, for getting the toaster. You know, we have an agenda each month of converting your children to homosexuality, and if I convert just three more of your children to homosexuality, I get the toaster oven this month. I am going to win the National Monthly Convert Your Child Homosexuality. You know, the pigs these people believe, it just will rock your world. It's hard to understand. There was a program on this morning, NBC's Morning Joe, it's called, and it's Willie Geist who's on there, and Joe Scarborough was on there. Even Joe Scarborough could not; he was speechless. They ran the audio clip of what I just told you, that the Constitution needed to be changed so that it reflected God's standards. Of course, then puts the separation of church and state completely aside. Do you know that we talk about the separation of church and state protecting the secular people, which of course it does, for people to practice whatever faith they want or not practice any faith they want. It protects them. But what these people don't realize is it protects the church. It protects the church too, because now that the church has basically married the Republican Party, each and every one of their scandals is wholly associated, the mind of any thinking person, that the Christian church and its conservative mess that we find on our hands, they equate it. So by separating the two, we not only protect secular society, we protect the church from the tarnishing and the dirt of the federal government, and it will always be tarnished. It will always be dirt. There will always be scandals. There will always be payola. There will always be lobbyists. Glory. As Bob would say. Glory, hallelujah. Preach it, Brother Peter. But I just have to tell you that if they only knew the depth to which the word Christianity has been tarnished by these pig-eyed louts that are in control of this country, they would be screaming for the separation of church and state. Just screaming. Anyway, that's a whole other story. How would you like to be a gay journalist in Russia? And all of a sudden you're just sitting there on a Saturday evening, alone in your apartment, minding your own business, and suddenly there is a knock on the door. And he opens the door. It was the KGB. Yes, I kid you not. He was a district officer from the militia, Department of the Central District, demanded to be let in. And he said he had reports of noise coming from the apartment upstairs. In other words, the noise that was coming from the man's apartment, the reporter, was bothering the people downstairs. Now, this sort of concerned the gay journalist who lived in the apartment because, number one, he was sitting in his apartment quietly, and there was no music, no television, no dancing guests. And number two, the neighbors downstairs are, in fact, a grocery store, which was closed for the night. Nonetheless, shortly after the militia showed up, the KGB arrived. They said they had a search warrant and demanded to open the door. This is because he is an openly gay journalist. He refused. He said they were going to break the door down if they did not let them in. And they told him he was suspected of involving pupils and students in the Young Front. Now, the Young Front is an opposition youth group that's been banned in Russia. Opposition regarding, disrespecting and then kicking LGBT folks in the face. Basically, he was being charged with, and this is a quote, he was being charged with the purpose to harm the state. We're not that far from this here. I know you don't always believe me when I tell you that, but we really aren't. Your telephone calls are being listened to. Your emails are being sifted through the UNIVAX 9000 that we call it, looking for keywords. Somebody who does something like what I'm doing here, somebody like Bob Kincaid who does what he does on his show, or John Fox, or Sowards, or Goodner, or Guy James, or there's a whole list of hosts. Even Billy Shears, all Billy Shears does is play his music at the show. Just because he's associated with Head On Radio Network, you can be damn sure that each and every one of us are monitored. I have no doubt. I hope this is going to scare off the people that email me. I have no doubt that my email is monitored. I really don't. This is what happens in this country. I'm talking about a country that sends agents to monitor the Quakers. The Quakers, because of their nonviolence, was considered a threat to the United States of America. People don't realize that. This happened in Florida. The Quakers meeting was investigated and filed away. I was talking to a dear friend earlier about some of the things that have happened in the United States regarding our public standing across the world and perhaps a feeling of shame about it. And he pointed out to me that we have a long history of people who have died to defend this country, who have spilled their blood and given up their lives so that we can have a radio station like the Head On Radio Network, and that we can say things that the moneyed and the powerful do not appreciate. And he reminded me that for that reason alone, we should love the country. And I completely agree with him, and I weep for the changes that have taken place, and Godspeed to bring it back to something that even remotely resembles what our forefathers fought and died for. So in any case, they had the search warrant, and I do tend to wander. They had the search warrant, and they burst into the door, and soon a group of his gay friends arrived, and they were just arriving to support the journalist. They offered to be witnesses to the search. They offered to be witnesses to what the militia and the KGB agents were doing. The militia and the KGB agents forced the friends to leave. They confiscated the journalist's hard disk drive. from his computer. You know, normally people just take the whole computer, but the article specifically says they took the hard disk drive from the computer. I guess they had on their little tool belts and their little teeny tiny screwdrivers. Or perhaps it was an external drive they confiscated and realized it was a drive C. Maybe his drive C was external. God, I am rambling tonight. But in any case, they also took off with his video camera and a flash memory stick. The man's name is Padsoni. It's hard to pronounce Russian name. He has fled to another area. He's now in hiding. You see, this is not the first time. Last year, November 23rd, which is not that long ago, mind you, November 23rd, I can still remember almost what I was doing November 23rd. The KGB took him aside, and they took him to the same man now, who they just burst in his apartment. They took him to the KGB department by force for what they referred to as a so-called talk. And they were interested in his work with the Poland-based satellite TV channel that he did reports on. And then 2 weeks later, the KGB's officers attempted to detain him again. The man with the hard-to-pronounce name is an openly gay and very well-known within the gay community and publisher and author. And that's the story. There's from the web, there's various photographs and what have you. But that's the story from Russia. Let's see, do I want to do that? No. Do I want to do this? Not really. Might as well do this. This fellow, this comes from the Blairco Project, our friends Bill Browning and his partner over at the Blairco Project. They've both been guests on this show, and both wonderful guests. And by the way, we're still in talks with them about a little project we might... a little collusion ourselves in the Blairco Project. And that said, we won't go any deeper than that. In fact, Bill and I spoke briefly today. But one of the fellows, one of the writers over at the Blairco Project, his name is Eric Marcus. I was pleased to see that his article today, he is echoing lines that I have stated in the past on this show. He takes it in a slightly different direction, but nonetheless, it's nice to see that others are beginning to say these things in the LGBT community. And he's talking about the effort that went on in the 1990s to rebrand the word queer. And Eric is saying that it always struck him as being misguided, and in fact, he puts in parentheses, always regarded as being stupid. You see, that was back in the day when the newscasters were just beginning to get comfortable using the word gay rather than homosexual. For activists and the young activists, they wanted change, and so what they decided to do is, well, let's embrace a word that's been used against us, and by using this word, we'll remove the prejudice from it, remove the sting, we'll transform it into a powerful positive word that includes gay men and lesbians and bisexuals and transgendered and queer, straight, and queer questioning and two spirited. And I realize I'm double minded on this. I constantly complain that LGBTQQTS, we really need a word. I'm not sure if the word queer is the correct one, but I'll tell you more about why I think that in just a moment. So what Eric is saying here, that nearly 20 years later, there is no majority of gay rights organizations in the world, that no major, rather, gay rights organization use the word queer as part of its name. Now, there are organizations that do, but he's just saying the major ones. And he says that even when the LGBT community extends LGBT to use the letter Q, it often stands for questioning. And he says you're most likely to see the word used in places of higher learning like queer studies, things like that. So he's saying here that it turns out that taking a word whose definition is negative and turning it into something positive is a very, 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 very steep hill. And that... it's especially true when the majority of the people who are supposed to support the use of this word don't support it and don't embrace it. And he goes on to say that taking a negative word that's been hurled at us for decades and decades and modifying its definition to take the focus off of us, he's just pointing out that that's what they were trying to do. He gives a little background. He says, when I was 14, I went to a summer camp where baseball was a critical part of the daily activities. I was bad at baseball. I loved the arts. I loved the craft. And, of course, this meant I was a faggot, at least by the standards of the fellow campers. So that's what they called me. They made me cry. I wish they were dead. I hated the word. I still hate the word. He says that my experience is hardly isolated. Few gay men have escaped the word faggot, as it's often used. High school students, conservative commentators like the Walking Dead, Adam's Apple, and Coulter use the word. It's an all-purpose put-down. So anyway, Eric was reading a few weeks back about the basketball scandal that's unfolding regarding steroids and use of steroids. And it occurred to him, and I have to agree with him in this sense, that those are the real faggots. He's saying that when professional baseball players who inject steroids and so on, and the team owners looked away, and he's saying that by faggot, what he's saying is they're greedy, they're weak-willed, they're liars, they're cheaters. And he says, but let's get broader here. Why stop there? Why not use the word faggot to include bullies and torturers, waterboarders, and those who set government policies? By my definition, the president and the vice president are both faggots. There's some humor here you have to laugh. And Ed Coulter's a faggot. Why limit it to just men? Way to go, Eric. He says, can homosexuals still be faggots? Well, hell yes, he's saying. Not quite, I put that in. But he says, by definition, yes, they have to earn it just like everyone else, though. He's saying that an elected politician who is gay and closeted and votes for anti-gay legislation is a faggot. He says, I'm tempted to say that Larry Craig is a faggot. But he's so pathetic, I feel sorry for him. So he's talking about creating the Faggot Hall of Fame in this way. And I agree with him on many of those points. My problem with the word faggot and queer, and I've said this on the show before, it's been a while since I've said this, but oft times the word faggot or the word queer are the very last words that gay men hear as they're being beaten to death or being hung on a fence in Wyoming or being abandoned in the field or being hit with a hammer. Sometimes the word queer and faggot, oft times I would expect, between the kicks and the stabs, those are the last words that those people hear. And I think that out of respect for the dead, we might like to avoid the use of those words. But hey, that's just me. Ookie-doke. God, Peter, you're so grim. Oh, let's talk about this. This is interesting. Let's talk about this. I don't want to talk about this big property battle, by the way, regarding the Episcopal churches. You know, they're separating now. They're splitting the 77 million congregations, 77 million people. The parts are splitting off to side with the Anglican bishops in Africa who oppose the theological views regarding openly gay bishops, et cetera, et cetera. So in this huge split that's going to happen, or is in the process of happening, or that's threatening to happen, and any number of things, it's hard to say exactly what the status is. It varies time to time, but it looks pretty grim. There's a huge property battle. It's like a nasty divorce. You see, in any case, there's a Virginia Attorney General. You see, these congregations that are splitting away, these congregations are sitting in Episcopal Church properties that are worth millions and millions of dollars. There's multiple churches. The land, these are in cities. The cost of the buildings, the value of the land, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the value of the property is huge. And it's like a nasty divorce. There's a huge battle on who gets the house. And I hate to see this, but this is what's happening. And this has all got to do with the divisive crap that we are not just like you. Well, the regular listeners of this show know that we're just like you. They damn well know it. And I love you for it. But nonetheless, and he's a Republican, of course. He's the Virginia Attorney General, and he's siding with the churches that are breaking away that they should get the property. And what he's doing is he is referring to a state law that goes back to the Civil War. And the Civil War law says that, the law allows a majority vote of the congregation to determine ownership and affiliation when a division, that's a quote from the law, has occurred within the denomination. I guess that there were church struggles and splits even back in the Civil War. That probably had something to do with the Baptist church. Church, branching off between the Baptists and the Southern Baptists. But in any case, the Episcopal Church is arguing that the state law is unconstitutional because it requires the court to wade into theological issues, such as whether or not a division has occurred within the Episcopal denomination. Because one could argue that either way, that there's really no division if you love Christ, yet these side issues are huge. In any case, McDonald also, this is the Republican, he writes that the Constitution does not require that local church property disputes be resolved by deferring to a national or regional church leader. And so they just want to look at deeds and that sort of thing rather than how the church law works. All churches have rules and bylaws regarding the property and the ownership. Our little Methodist church out here does. In fact, the people who built the church and donated the property, this is a very historic, it's an old historic church. The church is almost 200 years old, 180-something years old. Very, very, very old Methodist church. And the people who donated the land and built this little wooden white Methodist church in this little rural community, which is an intersection in the caution light, put it, I'd say I haven't, it's been a long time since I thought about this, but they put it in the church bylaws that if the church ever changed from anything other than Methodist, that the church would lose custody of the property. Now, I don't know who it would go to. I guess the heirs, the people who donated, I may be getting this partly wrong, but it's specifically the part that I know is correct is that if they changed from being a Methodist church to another denomination. In any case, though, so there are these rules and bylaws, but the Virginia Attorney General is siding with the breakaway churches. He's saying, well, hell yes, y'all get out of that old nasty church with them old nasty people trying to recruit our children. By the way, have I mentioned I'm going to get the toaster oven this month? But, well, I wasn't going to do that, but I did. But here's the story I was really, really, really going to tell you. You know, I've been talking lately going on about the watchman on the walls. I've done that on several nights. I've told you about the fact that this fellow Hutchison, who is in Ken Hutchison, he's a pastor of the Antioch Bible Church in Kirkland, Washington. He's the man who marched into a Microsoft stockholders meeting and told Microsoft that he had a lot of powerful white people on his side. I'm sorry. It's just a little funny, though. He doesn't mention God on his side, although I'm sure that's the reason Microsoft should fear is the powerful white people on his side. Good God in heaven. What has come of this country? So, then he's the one who we covered a few weeks ago, maybe it was last week, talking about this new plan. He wants every Christian in the world to buy 3 shares of Microsoft stock. This would cost at today's rates about $104 for the 3 shares per family or individual who buy it, and donate one of those shares to Ken Hutchison himself. This is the best pyramid scheme I have ever heard of. I've got to hand it to you, Ken. Millions of people buying Microsoft stock, and you get a cut. You get, in fact, a 33% cut, 33 1/3%. 999, whatever it might be, of the Microsoft stock. And this is going to be used to raise money to fight the other corporations who are enabling the homosexual agenda. But the reason I bring this up is the fact that, there's also Scott Lively, who's part of the Watchman on the Walls. He wrote the book, The Pink Swastika, saying that the homosexuals were the Nazi party and we were responsible for it, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the reason I'm bringing this all up in this long, convoluted story is the fact that a 32-year-old man who works as an aide, and this is over in Latvia, this man, I should connect the dots. This Watchman on the Walls has a huge church in Sacramento where a lot of people from that part of the world are moving to, from Latvia and what have you. And his church in I think it's Kirkland or whatever it is, Washington, where Microsoft is located. And then there is another church, a mega church, over in Latvia, you know. So, in fact, Hutchison has traveled over there and spoken to their huge congregations with the mega sound systems, that he is a representative of the United States and that he is authorized by President Bush himself to speak to other countries regarding the severe, the horrible issues of homosexuality and how we're taking over the country. And so he's stirring these people up badly. Now, these Latvians, these people have been repressed by the government for a long, long time, and so they're ready for somebody to be a scapegoat. They're ready for, you know, the big boogeyman, the big black nothing, as Bob would say from Never Ending Story, the big black nothing. They're fighting against the big black nothing out there, because you need an enemy to get people motivated to do the things that this 32-year-old man did. He works as an aide to the homophobic Latvian fellow. Let's see, what's his name? The Latvian guy. He's part of the Latvia First Party. His name is Danis Turlis. Well, the fellow who is 32, who has been convicted of gross public disorderliness, is Janis Devlim, as best as I can say it. The court found that he threw bags of excrement at the car of a gay rights activist. This was the gay pride parades, the gay pride celebrations that took place just last year. They were indeed happening in very small countries like Latvia, too. They were scaled back, and instead of having one huge one, they had them in smaller ones in several places, simply because the rage of the community was such that people were concerned. And in fact, some very terrible incidents did happen, and the police did not respond when people were being beaten. And anyway, he was sentenced to 100 hours of doing compulsory labor, and he says that was a tough sentence. And then there was a fine, I think it was like $3,400 in American money. And they, you know, they're letting him know that that sort of behavior will have serious consequences. And the government's saying the attack against homosexuals and their supporters is a hate crime against a specific group of society. This is why it has a very serious. And the prosecutor's office and the court agree with us, and today we feel safer, and blah, 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 and all these things about the guy got convicted, and that's all very good. But the rest of the story, as they would say, is the fact that this fellow and his boss, Danis Turlis, are part of a church called the New Something or Another, the New Generation Church. And guess who the New Generation Church is? Boy, I can't fool you guys for a second. They are part of Watchmen on the Walls, which is, of course, the militant, anti-gay, homophobic... let me put it like this. His boss, Turlis, has a reputation for saying things in Parliament, calling gays pigs, calling gays bacteria. They rarely mention lesbians. It's just the men. I guess they still... Well, it's just something going on. So anyway... I just wanted to tell you that as the sentiments are being escalated down in Sacramento, we had the death of a gay man in a park in San Fernando by these people. I just want to tell you that, yes, the anti-gay violence is starting to show up in Latvia, too, in a very profound way, and it's starting to show up in a way that is indeed directly linkable to these hate speeches that are being given at New Generation Church and connected to Washington on the Walls and connected to Ken Hutchison, who is going to shut down Microsoft by everybody in the United States buying 3 shares and giving him one, and Lively, who wrote the book The Pink Swastika, Homosexuals and the Nazi Party, and on and on and on. Just wanted to show you that there is a connection there. There is a connection, a direct connection, between what is taught in the church and what is permissible in society. Yes, there is. And I have documentation that's buried in my stack somewhere. A fellow who walked into a gay bar. Here, I remember part of it without even seeing the article. The fellow's last name was Gay, right? Okay, so he's what, 20, 30 years old? And he had been, all of his life, people have teased him because, ha, 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 your last name is Gay. Okay, well, he wasn't gay. His last name was Gay. So... he walked into a gay bar. Don't remember the city. It's in the stack somewhere. When I find it, I'll tell you about it probably another night. But walked into a gay bar and pulled out a shotgun and began killing people. Some are dead. Some are severely wounded and are in various levels of physical disability because of the gunshot wounds. Some are emotionally scarred from having even been there. And what did he say to the police? He was doing it for God. Jesus wept. Absolutely wept. So I saw that today. I've been beating up on the watchmen on the walls for quite a little while now, so thought I would just show you the link, as if my intelligent and highly educated and Johnny-on-the-spot listeners did not know that there was a link. I'm just telling you that there, in fact, was. Oh, it's almost bottom of the hour. There are other stories to do, but I think what I want to do, we'll maybe get in a couple of stories later, but I'm ready for a break. I'm ready to go to the gay bar across the street. I truly am. I am, like, so totally ready to go to the gay bar across the street. Oh, I can't begin to tell you. As we've talked about over the last few nights, we have a, I hate to call it a stable, it sounds so pornographic, but we have a stable of the world's most fabulous DJs on the planet, and this is a fact. We have people who are being, VJC, we had Jerry Bonham was on Monday, VJC was last night, Victor from Disco 935. Tonight we have the world's most dangerous DJ, Mr. Larry Sanders, who is in California. Tomorrow night we will have VJC again for another set. Friday we have the incredible Bobby Vittoretti. Monday, the Italo disco expert Alec Ntikken with the Dutch DJ Martin Verlan. And Tuesday, and this is as far, there are other people to schedule, but we're only scheduled up as far as Tuesday. We'll have our very own Billy Shears. And but tonight, it's our dear friend Larry Sanders. And so the gay bar across the street is, and it's kind of appropriate. I live out in the middle of nowhere, at just like the little small town gay bar called Rumors from the movie Small Town Gay Bar. And by the way, if you haven't seen Small Town Gay Bar, you should. It's an amazing story of Donald Wildman and Fred Phelps and the attitudes of LGBT folks who live in the rural, extreme rural Mississippi, Alabama areas and what have you. But in any case, that's how it became called, the bar across the street became called Rumors, because, in fact, the little bar that exists in the movie, it's a documentary called Small Town Gay Bar, is called Rumors. So as we head over to the gay bar across the street, the party is already in progress. We're about to walk in on the set. Larry Sanders is already playing, and it is from the Fire Island Master Mix. All of these mixes are available at MorningstarMelody.com, and the proceeds for these I'll go to charity. Prepare to be amazed, Larry Sanders. We'll be right back.
Feel your way.
So now it is time to return to the real world, to quote one of the lines from the Never Ending Story remix. Larry, thank you. That was we've been watching, by the way, in the chat room. We really should stop in the chat room at some point if you haven't already. We've been watching Larry dance in the chat room. The chat room moderators, I have to tell you, are a never-ending quest to come up with new animation. In fact, they have an animation of myself. My head is on John Travolta's body, so is Larry's, and so are all of the other people who submit music to the show. And during this track, we get to watch, we have a dancing cowboy, we have a dancing Larry Sanders, there's a dancing Larry Peter Godbold, and the list goes on, a dancing Billy Shears, dancing VJC. Oh, the evil that comes from the chat room. You just gotta love those people. I hate to go back to this nasty old news again. We've got a few more minutes, so I do want to tell you a little bit about Mike Huckabee as if you haven't heard enough already, but I came across an absolutely wonderful quote today regarding Mike Huckabee, the possibility that he might become a president, saying that we, being the progressives, we fear Mike Huckabee's presidency as a slug might fear salt. And that's absolutely true. Yeah, there's some people here. We have a woman named Trisha, and she is a supporter of Huckabee, and she is saying that social issues such as abortion and gay marriage are largely what drew her to Huckabee. I see a lot of things changing and a lot of things happening. For instance, the homosexual agenda, which we are experts here. She says there are things that I feel like I need to have a say in what's going on. And since becoming a Christian in 1996, I guess that's when she got her, never mind. She says she's been kind of under the impression that Christians just stayed out of politics. Lord, what a, this woman is as bright as a small appliance light bulb. She says that Huckabee's campaign has set her straight on that. He's not afraid to speak out about his faith. Like he says, you don't have to tuck your religion in your back pocket. It's a part of you. But, oh, that is only the beginning of the horror. There is a forum out there, a forum called HucksArmy.com. Mike Huckabee's Army.com. It's, don't recommend you go there. You might not sleep. But I'm going to give you a little sample of some of the things that is appearing at HucksArmy.com. This is from Larry Hicks in Texas. Hi, guys. I'm new to this forum and just recently got into Huckabee because my friend Stephen, had been gay for about 5 years secretly, although I knew as his best friend. After meeting Mike Huckabee at a rally and discussing his secret, Mike quoted a few scriptures to Stephen and helped him open his eyes to the sinful life he was living. Stephen has changed his lifestyle and has become one with God and accepted Christ as his Lord and Savior. I am so happy that Mike took it upon himself to help lead my friend in the right direction. Well, isn't that special? Isn't that just special? And the one replies, I think that's great and awesome, 2 exclamations. When I was a teenager, I had lustful thoughts, and I didn't have anyone to ask about them because we didn't go to church. But about that time, when I had found God in my Gideon Bible, I'm sorry. Oh, it's pitiful. Jesus wept. It is pitiful. I know it's pitiful, but for crying out loud, if I didn't laugh, I would bust a seam. I got to tell you, I found God in my Gideon Bible, and I was starting to rely on it for strength. And I prayed to God to take away those sinful, lustful ideas that the devil kept putting in my head, and they left and never came back. Isn't that special? Simple faith, I sincerely believe that God led your friend to Mike Huckabee and told Mike Huckabee what to say to your friend. God works through people, especially pastors, so we can credit Mike with some of it. And I'm sure your friend is going to find a great life in God. I'm sure his friend will as soon as he finds him. It goes on ad nauseum like that. I believe Mike led your friend to the great physician. It was him that actually did the curing, not Mike. I know how God changes. You see, all of this is just about right on target, but it's the equivalent of sweet and low to sugar. It is saccharine. It is fake. It's Republican. Stephen has changed his lifestyle and become one with God and accepted Christ. He'll have to do it again because whatever the hell he accepted doesn't love him the way Christ would. Jesus Christ. No. Quote was sent to me today from the Ragamuffin Gospel, and I pulled it out because it was meaningful to me. The quote is from Brennan Manning. He wrote the Ragamuffin Gospel, one of my favorite books. Christ is manifested, the quote says, Christ is manifested in our deep and delicate respect for one another. Anybody doubt that? I sure as hell don't doubt that. There's a stack of Huckabee horrors. I think I've probably scared you enough for now. No sense in really turning your hair white this evening. But I do want to tell you about Nancy Pelosi, our wonderful Nancy Pelosi, with impeachment is off the table. Impeachment is off the table, Senator and Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. Well, guess what she's up to now? She will not. Well, not only is impeachment on the table, she's refusing to help the Foley investigators. If you'll recall, Foley was the Republican who had for many, many, many years sexually approached young pages while they were working in the White House. And he was commonly known in some of the gay bars in the area as being someone who would come in and went after younger guys or people under 18 if he could get them. The thing about Foley, if you'll recall, this is a while. I mean, there's so many Republican scandals. I know these names blur together. There's Foley and Craig and what's-his-face, the madam guy down in baby diaper guy who had the prostitutes put him in a baby diaper now, who lives in New Orleans somewhere. And all of these are famous Republicans, each and every one. Thank you, Bob. David Vitter, the huggy man. So in any case, getting back to Senator Pelosi. You see, Mark Foley lives in Florida. Mark Foley is now living actually in South Florida. He is in real estate. Isn't it? It's divine justice that real estate's falling apart. A lot of people try to earn a living. I shouldn't say that. But Foley's in real estate in South Florida. In any case, Florida law enforcement officials, read that, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement, have been denied access to the office computers of Congressman Mark Foley. Now, this is despite a direct appeal to the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, for help in their investigation. This is a law enforcement agency, the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. Their central office is just down the road in Tallahassee. They need the office computers to complete their investigation regarding the sexually explicit messages sent to current and former teenage congressional pages. In a letter, it's a response, a letter that was sent to Pelosi last month by the Florida Department of Law Enforcement. The deputy counsel, the reply came back denied. The representative from the FDLE is saying that we've received the response, the team is reviewing it. The FDLE spokesman Heather Smith told ABC News that they're despite the House's refusal to provide the computer, FDLE is still investigating the former Republican who now sells real estate in Palm Beach. And Foley, of course, resigned September the 29th of 2006, just moments ago in geological time, because the pages he was going after were under 18 years of age. And the federal officials turned the case over to Florida after concluding that Foley hadn't engaged in actual sexual contact with the former pages until they had turned 18, at least the ones they know about. And, you know, I'll have to finish this up on another evening. You know, as usual, there's never enough minutes in the show. And I'm not a big enough boy to go to a three-hour show yet. But as I get to be a bigger boy, I will probably dare to do a three-hour show. But for right now, we're sticking with 2 hours. So that handles it. Listen, I need to tell you that There will not be a horn section this evening. Reason being, I need to turn in early tonight. I have a dentist appointment in the morning. Also, reason being, John has a huge gig in Australia that he is about to leave for, and that's very important. So, which would leave Bob all by himself as the horn section. So, we're not going to do it. So, no horn section tonight. Also, John Fox's show at midnight will be a replay of both the shows. And thank you for being here. Love you guys. So, in closing, here's Cynthia Manley reminding you to.